And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Chinese are quickly accommodating to becoming master consumers as people in the hills of West Virginia watch their mountains lopped off to power the power plants that keep the big machine rolling. American economists fear there may not be enough younger generation to take care of the burgeoning older generation. Some stand in the midst of it all, look around and wonder, which way do we go to the future? We'll head off to find out when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Mid-December 2006. Another Christmas, or Hanukkah, or Kwanzaa, to wrap up the gift of life, of which we're all recipients. We'll save the final wrap-up for another show. But 2007 is about to birth. And as with any growing being, we, who now refer to ourselves as a global community, need to learn from our past to direct our future course. Today we present a tale of two directions. And as any wise being knows, you simply cannot go in two directions at once. And yet, that is what's being expected of all of us. Is there a clear-cut answer? That is the critical question, perhaps, of our age. For as we live to be free and die for the right of people to choose according to their free will, or at least to be led by those who capture the majority, no matter how small, there is, within the will to live free or die, too free a will to die, not because we will it, but because we will not use the wisdom upon which life itself has come to be. We start our show with a celebration of great wonder as we travel to Yosemite National Park and learn about an 80-year-old holiday tradition of feasting and singing in peace on earth, goodwill towards men, women, and children. Then in segments 2 and 3, we visit the paradox that opened this show, Which Way to the Future, as we hear the arguments of the emerging birth-dearth debate. Some will say we are suffering the effects of overpopulation that so many feel in our everyday lives, and yet others are saying we need more people to keep our societies intact. So which way is the future? We'll head on off to find out following the news. So first, the news. People on planet Earth, and that means most of us, are under global attack by our sun. As the 12-year solar cycle accelerates into a period of increased activity, Wednesday's gigantic solar flare has put many agencies, power companies, and communications networks on high alert. Beginning midday today, Thursday, the Earth will be in for a powerful geomagnetic storm, which can affect radio communications, satellites, and power grids, which could experience potential damage or interruptions. The upside of these celestial events is that those in the northern hemisphere may witness some spectacular northern lights. Solar flares send radiation to Earth within minutes of the eruption. Some are accompanied by coronal mass ejections, clouds of charged particles that arrive in a day or two. This flare has a strong coronal mass ejection component that is headed our way. Known as sunspot number 930, this may be the beginning of a long stretch of such occurrences which could present new challenges to an already challenged world. In Idaho Wednesday, residents were yelling, "Ducks!" Over 1,000 ducks already have been discovered, dead and in an area about 180 miles south of Boise. The animals are scattered over quite a large area. State wildlife biologists and the U.S. Department of Homeland Security are investigating, as they are not ruling out any possible causes. The ducks appear to be dying from a combination of lesions in the lungs and hemorrhaging of the heart wall, which indicates a bacterial infection. However, this is not an indicator of avian flu. The sudden outbreak puzzles scientists as it affects mallard ducks exclusively. Eagles, geese, crows, and other birds in the area show no signs of distress. At this time, suspected causes include pesticide poisoning from a nearby feedlot or farming chemicals that may have contaminated a creek where many of the dead and dying birds are found. The devastation of the Ebola virus is not limited to human populations, as it is now being blamed for a massive die-off of gorillas in Central and Western Africa. Fully 90% of all gorillas in the path of the spreading infection die. Moving at the rate of 31 miles per year, the future of the gorilla populations looks bleak, as most of the area's gorillas live within a range of 124 miles of the current outbreak. Ebola has already affected two of the greatest gorilla preserves and three of the four secondary reserves. Ape species that were abundant and widely distributed a decade ago are rapidly being reduced to tiny remnant populations. The hope that an effective vaccine may be developed in time holds a glimmer of promise that the world's gorillas may have any chance of survival at all. This emerging crisis reduces the window of opportunity to save these amazing creatures to a pinhole. With all the challenges facing not only we humans, but our fellow travelers on this little tiny insignificant speck of dust in the vast, unfathomable vastness of our universe, actor and activist Leonardo DiCaprio is inviting every single person to apply their greatest wisdom to come up with answers for the global warming crisis. If you have an answer, go to globalgreen.org and become part of the solution. And that's the news. And a reminder, while you're thinking about how to stop global warming for Leonardo DiCaprio, send off some of your solutions to the Wildside News. We'll share them with the world. As the great spirit of this, our most festive holiday season, draws near, we now head on up to one of America's grandest national parks as they launch a series of historic celebrations in a most glorious way. All of us are blessed to have as part of our legacy the National Park Service and the National Park System, actually, which we find in every state in the country, a representative of the National Parks. And the National Parks serve many, many purposes. Obviously, they're treasures of our natural legacy and as well historic legacy. Many of these parks go way back. There's a wealth of historic architecture and buildings make up the history of parks. And these buildings are maintained and become landmarks that we all appreciate. One of the legendary landmarks in the national park system is the Ahwahnee, which is in Yosemite National Park. And they have, every winter, this time of the year, a special celebration that we're going to find out a lot more about. And to help us understand that is Kenny Karst, who works with the Ahwahnee. Kenny, welcome to the Wildside News.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the program.
First of all, talk about the Ahwahnee, what it is, how it came to be. Let's start with that.
The Ahwahnee is Yosemite's crown jewel from a property standpoint. Most people think of Yosemite National Park and its magnificent granite domes, waterfalls, and wildlife. The Ahwahnee stands today, actually, thanks to Stephen Mather, who was the first director of the National Park Service. And following the creation of the National Park Service in 1916, Mather embarked on an aggressive campaign to increase support and funding for national parks. Well, Yosemite was Mather's favorite of the national parks, and he sought to upgrade the park's concession operations and accommodations. So in 1925, he ordered the new park concessionaire at the time, Yosemite Park and Curry Company, to build a first-class hotel that would be open year-round to attract people of influence, predominantly from the San Francisco Bay Area, because that was the park's area sphere of influence, if you will. So a gentleman by the name of Gilbert Stanley Underwood was chosen as the architect for Yosemite's new luxury hotel, and was actually built within 1 year, which is astounding when you think about it. The hotel was slated to be three times the actual size that it turned out, but it was able to be constructed totally in 1 year. And today stands almost exactly as it did when it was first finished in 1927, almost 80 years ago.
Give us a visual of the Ahwahnee as it is today and some of the features that make it so unique.
Underwood's original design showed an impressive building consisting of a central tower, 7 stories high with 3 extending wings. The north wing contains an entry lobby, a bar area. The concierge is located there. The south wing contains the great lounge and 2 stories of meeting rooms. And the west wing contains the enormous dining room, which floor to ceiling is 53 feet in height. It's
wow.
Truly magnificent. And then there are 124 guest rooms overall on the property, 99 of which are located in the main structure of the hotel. A year later, in 1928, Underwood and his associates constructed 24 cottages. So all told, there are 123 guest rooms.
Fabulous. Well, it's a landmark location for people visiting the parks. There's many ways to visit a park. Some people bring a sleeping bag. Some people sleep in the back of their car and RVs and every other form. But as well, for those who wish to really make a holiday of it, there are these extraordinary places like the Ahwahnee to really enjoy life in a 4-star hotel.
Indeed, and you know, a lot of people actually combine all of those ideas. It's not uncommon for someone to go backpacking in Yosemite and experience the great outdoors, and then as they arrive back in Yosemite Valley, spend the last night or two of their vacation at the Ahwahnee, so they're really able to enjoy all of the splendor that the park has to offer.
That's a great mix. I like that. That sounds like a lot of fun. The Ahwahnee at this point is now run as a concession. It's a standard in the park system. It's run by a corporation whose job it is to really maintain the facility and provide first-class accommodations and services. Talk to us a little bit about who's in charge of running the Ahwahnee at this point.
It's Delaware North Companies. DNC Parks and Resorts at Yosemite is a subsidiary of the Buffalo, New York-based Delaware North Companies, which is a leading hospitality provider with significant experience in hotel, retail, food service, recreation, and even transportation operations. Yosemite is one of multiple properties within its parks and resorts portfolio. Just briefly, a couple of other properties, and this may surprise some of your listeners, in addition to other national parks that we run concessions in, like Yellowstone, Sequoia, Grand Canyon, we also are the concessionaire for the Kennedy Space Center in Florida and multiple other places, the U.S. Mint, Denver, Asilomar Conference Grounds in the Monterey Peninsula, and on and on. We have had the contract with the National Park Service to run the concessions in Yosemite since 1993. That contract is up for renewal in October of 2011. We have every expectation that it will be renewed with us. We've instituted a lot of very unique programs. When we became the manager of the visitor services in Yosemite in 1993, we quickly became known in the industry for innovative environmental practices and management style. And we developed and implemented a comprehensive, award-winning environmental management program called GreenPath, which has earned registration through the International Organization for Standardization. Many people may know that acronym, ISO. For all Delaware North Parks and Resorts locations. So that, in a sense, is one of the things that we bring to the table in our stewardship of the national park. There are many people here in Yosemite who have been here and worked in the park for the concessionaire even before Delaware North became a player in Yosemite. In other words, people that had worked for Yosemite Park and Curry Company stayed on when Delaware North acquired the contract in 1993. And it's not uncommon, for instance, if you go into the Ahwahnee dining room, the average tenure of the wait staff there is 20 years.
Wow.
Other folks have been here 30, some even 40 years. So there's a real love for the park and the people that work and play here.
Well, that's a perfect segue to talk about what's happening over the holidays here, because you've, as well as that, the wait staff and the professional staff that services the friends of the Ahwahnee, you also have inherited a tradition that is ongoing, and this goes way back. Why don't you talk about this very special event that's ongoing as we speak and will be continuing throughout the rest of this year?
Yosemite in the Christmas time is world-renowned for an event call it the Bracebridge Dinner, which is a spectacular three-hour Christmas pageant and a holiday tradition of grand proportion. The Ahwahnee Dining Room is transferred into the majestic hall of American author Washington Irving's legendary Squire Bracebridge character for this Yuletide feast, which is complete with a seven-course gourmet dinner, costumed characters, lively carols, dancing. It is truly a grand pageant in every sense of that phrase. One thing that many folks who are familiar with Bracebridge might not know is that the Bracebridge dinner is no longer a lottery. About 3 years ago, we added three performances to the five, so there are now eight performances total. And as a result of that, it is now first come, first serve. So those of you who have been wanting to come and haven't had a chance because it's been on a lottery basis and sold out, we encourage you to call for reservations. It's truly a grand pageant.
Give us the dates that the dinners will be happening.
This year, the dates of the performances actually start on this coming Friday, the 15th. That's the first one. The second one will be Saturday, the 16th, then Monday, the 18th, Tuesday, the 19th, Thursday, the 21st, Friday, the 22nd, Sunday, the 24th, and concluding on Boxing Day, as they would say in England, on Tuesday, the 26th of December. Many folks will come and actually stay at the Ahwahnee. There are packages available for two and three nights, and they're all available through our phone number and website, which we'll give at the conclusion. And they're available at the Ahwahnee and also at a second lodging facility called Yosemite Lodge at the Falls, which is appropriately named due to its proximity to the base of Yosemite Falls. There are also two-night packages available at the Wawona Hotel in the south end of Yosemite, a grand hotel and National Historic Landmark as well, sort of a Victorian style. So people will come for several days, and the culminating feature, if you will, is obviously the pageant itself, the Bracebridge Dinner. It's truly magnificent. If any of your listeners have been to a Renaissance fair, imagine the grand regal version of the clothing worn by folks who attend those types of fairs, and that's what you'll see at the Bracebridge Dinner. Squire Bracebridge is essentially having a Christmas pageant for his entire royal family, who are set on a stage of regal proportion in the far west alcove of the dining room, facing the rest of the entourage, which would be the guests who are attending the Bracebridge Dinner. And these very elaborate menu entrees will come out by the individual waiters, and they'll first serve all of the royal court, these grand meal entrees, if you will. And then, one by one, a huge procession of the waitstaff will come out from the kitchen and proceed to serve approximately 300 people inside the dining room, simultaneously, the very same entree that's been presented to Squire Bracebridge and his royal family. So the people that are in Bracebridge Hall, if you will, because that's what we call it during the season, the dining room, actually participate in this pageant because they're eating the same foods that the royal family are eating, all the while music playing, very period Renaissance, medieval, if you will, style music, multiple influences, predominantly singing, extraordinary choral singing, which will drive you to tears at one moment because of its beauty and then have you laughing on other instances because of its comedic value. There's a lot going on, much of which I would love to tell you, but it would ruin some of the surprises for your listeners. So I encourage that they come and savor all of the delectable dishes prepared by the Ahwahnee's world-class culinary staff, and witness this grand performance.
It's a splendid holiday event, something that anybody who partakes in will cherish the rest of their lives. And the good news is the fact that you're not totally booked up.
Well, there are still several performances that are not sold out. The good news is your listeners can acquire that information very easily by two means, one of which is to call the Central Reservations Office for Yosemite or to go online. The phone number for the reservations office is area code 559-253-5676, or you can simply go online at www.yosemitepark.com. www.yosemitesgrand.com and follow the left-hand column to special events and make reservations right online.
Well, now, Kenny, the question that I have to ask is, how many of these dinners can you take before you just can't take any more? I mean, I guess you'd put on about 600 pounds if you were to participate in all of these, but what's your role in this? How do you enjoy this?
Well, as the public relations manager, I have the tedious task of attending multiple sessions, hosting both print and broadcast media here in Yosemite who are covering the event. As the saying goes, it's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
As a musician myself, I play the slide trombone. I have great affection for this pageant. There is glorious operatic singing, which will make you run through the gamut of your emotions. And I can tell you that I'm going to be attending four of the sessions this year, of the eight, and I'm looking forward to every single one of them. I don't think I could ever get tired of this pageant. And there are a lot of folks that feel the same way, and you'd be surprised how many folks are returning guests from previous years. They share my love of this pageant.
It's a great feature to have as part of our National Park legacy. Kenny Carrs with the Awanee, I want to thank you so much for helping us appreciate a legendary, historic pageant that takes place each year in Yosemite. Thanks.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
One just may wonder, what great traditions those who are alive 80 years from now will be celebrating. What from our era will those then thank us for? Kind of makes you think. And that's what we're about to do when we take a step in two directions as we try to decide which way is the future. It's coming up when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Curiouser and curiouser. That's what Alice said as she sampled the biscuits and bottles in her mysterious journey. One made her taller, and one made her smaller. Which one to choose? We're moving into an Alice in Wonderland world, as scientists make the case that on one hand, there are just too many people on the planet, while others are encouraging mothers to have more babies to serve the future. Curiouser and curiouser. Which way takes us to the future? Stay tuned. They call it birth dearth, if you can believe it, and it's being touted as a new problem in developed nations around the world. The claims? There are just too few people being born. E, the environmental magazine, takes a look at this in their current issue, which we will be exploring in the next two segments. A lot of you who are out shopping this time of the year may be stuck in some Walmart or Fry's or some other place and maybe have a little bit shopped out, and you wander over to the magazine rack. And those of us who are environmentally sensitive, you know, tend towards the nature magazines, different things, and environmental magazines. And there's a magazine that you may notice this year because it is a beautiful cover, literally. And this is E. You'll notice a great big yellow E. And it's the environmental magazine. Covers a whole spectrum of issues that relate to that concept, E, the environmental magazine. And joining us now from Connecticut, beautiful state, is Jim Motovalli. Jim, welcome to the Wild Side News. You're the editor. Talk about your magazine, how long it's been, and give us a little history.
Well, E actually is now 16 years old. I've been with the magazine 10. And we were founded in 1990, which was the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. And there was a great upsurge of interest in environmental issues at that time. And there was some of the first notice of global warming at that time. And it was also around the period where all this medical waste was found washed up on the beaches.
Yeah.
There started to be concern about how we were treating the oceans.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a huge Earth Day commemoration that year. And that's sort of what E grew out of, is that celebration then. And I was then editing a local newspaper here, but the publisher, Doug Moss, was a good friend of mine, and gradually I spent more time over here than over there. So, and I came to E, I think, in 1995 or so, around in there. And we are probably the largest independent environmental magazine. We're not nearly as big as Sierra or Audubon magazine. Those are sent free to subscribers or members of Audubon or the Sierra Club. We are an independent magazine that is able to pretty much say what we want about different movements in the environment.
Right. That's the nice thing about being independent. You can say whatever you'd like. We'll talk about the mission of E, the environmental magazine.
Well, we like to think we have an informational mission. We want people to be more informed about environmental issues. And the way we do it is by making the information as accessible as possible. A lot of environmental information is first presented as peer-reviewed science, which means that it can be impenetrable to the average reader. We basically translate that into popular science that the average person with a high school education could probably read with no problem. And all of our stories come with lots of contact information, so that if you want to follow the subject up, learn more about it, you can do that too. And we are a popular newsstand publication. We're on, I think, more than any other environmental magazine, we're on Barnes & Noble and Borders newsstands. If you have a relatively large newsstand in your town, you probably can find E without too much trouble.
And then, of course, you have an online presence as well.
At emagazine.com. And if people go there, they can have a free copy of the magazine sent to them.
I use that as a source for news on a regular basis for looking for features and new topics and things like that. I rely on E Magazine. And there's a link from the Wild Side News page to E, the environmental magazine.
That's great to hear.
Mm-hmm, you bet. Well, that's what I do, too. I'm trying to make sure that people have access to the broad spectrum of information that's out there. You have a nice balance of focus with every issue. And you come out every 2 months?
Every 2 months, yeah. So there's 6 issues a year.
In the current issue, which is the November-December issue, there's a topic that, quite honestly, somehow the term birth dearth, that one slipped by me, but it's a focus of this particular issue. Jim, let's get into this topic and talk about why this captured your interest and then what it actually means to the rest of us.
Well, ever since Paul Ehrlich wrote The Population Bomb in the 60s, people have been concerned that the population of the Earth was growing beyond the carrying capacity of the planet. For instance, how many people can the Earth actually support? Can we just keep growing as a species and still count on the Earth to provide for everybody on the planet? A lot of people, including Paul Ehrlich and many people since, have thought that we were giving birth to too many people in terms of what the Earth could support. And I think when Paul Ehrlich's book came out in the 60s, there was probably 2 billion people on the Earth. Now we have 6.5 billion people. And while we don't have mass starvation, except in, I would say, artificially induced, often by conflict, as in places like Darfur and other places around the world, what we have are the makings of a huge environmental crisis caused by, among other things, excessive population growth. Now, the idea of the birth dearth really refers to the fact that in most of the settled world or the industrialized world, the birth rate has been shrinking for a long time. If you look at Western Europe, Eastern Europe, Russia, Japan, and to a lesser extent the United States, you see that basically there is below replacement level fertility, which means that if you have a married couple, they have either two children or less than two children. Obviously, you can't actually have less than two children, but you can do that demographically. So that means zero population growth. If you're just replacing yourselves, you're not growing the population.
But, which is a growth rate of two.
Right.
Two is a balance point.
Actually, it's a little more than two. It's like 2.1.
I suppose.
And I couldn't explain to you why that is. So in many parts of Western Europe, like in Italy or Spain, the birth rate is like 1.3, 1.4. Very, very low. Sweden, Japan has a very low birth rate. So these countries, which have also very low immigration rates, are in danger of shrinking dramatically in terms of their population. It hasn't happened to a huge extent yet, but that's what the demographics project is going to happen because of the aging of the population and other factors. Now, this birth dearth has been somewhat widely publicized. The point of our article, is there really a birth dearth, is to look at it holistically or internationally. And if you look at it internationally, you see there's many parts of the world where the birth rate is still very, very high. And because of that, and because of what's called population momentum, which means that if your population is very young, if you have many, many young people, the population is going to continue to grow even as the birth rate shrinks.
Lots of younger reproducers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have 6.5 billion people right now, the projections are we will have 9, 10, or 11 billion people by 2050.
It's a very complex issue in the sense that there's two sides to this.
The birth dearth is real, and many countries are experiencing it, and it's very dramatic for them. The United States, as I said, is a pretty complicated case.
It is.
Because while we have zero population growth, if you look at the native-born population, we also have very high immigration rates of a million legal immigrants a year and 2 million illegal immigrants a year. So our population is going to grow quite a bit even while the birth rate is stagnant.
It's an astonishing number, by the way. That comes up to 3 million per year additional population.
Right. It tends to be concentrated in specific states, too. Because immigrants go where there are other immigrants who've gone before. So states like California and New York see really a whole lot of immigration. Other states may not see very much at all.
And then, of course, in the underdeveloped world, it's quite a different story.
And again, it's very episodic, or depends on where you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Latin America, for instance, is experiencing a birth dearth. Many parts of Latin America are. People might be surprised to learn that Mexico, for instance, has dramatic decreases in fertility. That has a big implication for how many Mexicans might want to come to the United States in the next 40 or 50 years. Maybe there wouldn't be such pressure at the border because of declining population. I think that's probably pretty likely.
I think the complex part of this is that I'm in California, and almost everybody that I ever meet talks about the we're just too many people. I mean, we just feel there's far too many people.
Well, as I said, California is a huge destination state for immigrants.
It is. And so for us, the concept of a lowering population is something that many of us think, that's a great idea, you know. But there's this other side, which is the negative side of birth dearth, which I'd like you to cover a little bit, because I think some people may not quite understand why people would even consider that to be a negative.
Well, the main negatives are economic. If, for instance, in the United States, we're very dependent on very cheap minimum wage labor to keep our McDonald's open and our Burger Kings and our Kentucky Fried Chickens and our Walmarts. I mean, these places are run quite a bit by immigrant, young immigrant labor. And if that flow decreases, you'd have pressure to raise the minimum wage and probably unionize, all the things that business hates. So I think one of the biggest forces keeping immigration rates high is the business lobby.
Mm-hmm. And as well, then, of course, you have the elders who rely on this young workforce to keep their Social Security and their support mechanisms in place, and that becomes the negative side of the birth dearth.
Right, and you have to acknowledge that in some countries where you have a real graying population, it puts enormous burden on, particularly if it's, you're talking about a welfare state, like, say, Scandinavia. To keep those welfare states going, you really do need younger people to provide engines for the economy rather than just a very gray population that's mostly recipients of aid. It's sort of a formula for disaster.
In the Scandinavian countries, how are they addressing this then? Because you're absolutely right. They are socialized societies. The birth dearth is affecting them. What are their plans to deal with this? Do you know?
Well, not so much in Scandinavia. I haven't heard that they've really made many plans to address it. But if you look at a country like France, they have many inducements now for women to have more than two children. There are great economic breaks that you can't obtain if you have multiple children now.
Leave it to the French to come up with an idea like that.
And it's actually had an effect on the birth rate. Their birth rate is higher than it would have been, say, a few years before they instituted these changes. I mean, they still have a declining birth rate. Australia, too, has inaugurated programs to encourage women to have more children. Meanwhile, in China, for instance, they have what you might call a coercive policy to prevent women from having more than one or two children.
As we look at this interplay between the decliners and the and those that still are charging forward, for example, Saudi Arabia and areas in Africa, Niger, for example, their birth rates are tremendous. How does this then play out on the global stage?
The idea that we're having this birth dearth and that therefore the population issue is no longer applicable, that is beginning to get wide currency, and my point is that that's dramatically wrong because of countries like Niger, where women can have as many 10, or I think the average is 8 children for every woman in Niger, and that's combined with very poor health standards, very high maternal death rates, and as well as child death rates are very high in countries like that. It obviously does nobody any good for the birth rates to be as high as they are in Niger and in places like that. In much of the Middle East, there's still very high birth rates, and in most of Africa, that's true too. It's also true that the United States positions under the Bush administration have been to discourage distribution of birth control, largely because they link that to abortion. And that has actually started to increase birth rates in some African countries, as I report in the story. I talk particularly about the example of Kenya, where there seems to be increasing fertility, which is very much against the norm around the world.
One of the things I found interesting in your article was that there also is, I don't exactly know how to, I don't have a term for this, but that there actually is a global fundamentalist advantage to not having birth control that is literally being discussed from the politics of religion. Help me out.
I think one of the things we're facing as a result of some societies and some religious groups encouraging very high birth rates, examples would be the Mormons, fundamentalist Islam, Hasidic Jews. These populations all encourage very, very large families. And one way of looking at it is that you would end up getting a whole lot more and larger percentage of religiously inclined people because of those high birth rates that contrast to very low birth rates in the population at large.
Well, and without treading on religious practices, because that isn't what anyone intends to do, but I think generally speaking, the world is struggling to deal with fundamentalism in all of its forms.
And fundamentalists tend to have very large families. Mm-hmm. That's generally been the case.
Well, and unfortunately, the fundamentalists are the ones that seem to be battling and killing each other right now. So there is this, there's this dynamic. In some cases, some countries are struggling to say, my gosh, we have to deal with our lack of population. And in other countries, there is too much population. So there is no simple answer to this. And so I think part of the reason for you to bring this up is just make us aware of the fact that some of these discussions about this birth dearth need to really be looked at in a much more, realistic and balanced way.
It's really important to say that a large part of the movement that's, say, against immigration in the U.S., that the main point is anti-immigrant, a lot of that is racist. And a lot of that should be condemned for that reason. Their main interest is to keep other races out of the United States. I would say that is certainly, in writing about population, that's never my motivation. I don't care what color immigrants are. All I care about is the number of people that are coming into the country. I do think we should have quotas on immigrants that are much lower than what we have. I think we probably should have a level of about 300,000, because I think population growth in the United States is unsustainable. It's what sets us apart from Western Europe, Japan, Russia, large parts of the world where they're actually seeing a shrinking population. Some degree of immigration, I think, is probably a good thing. And that's why I say I wouldn't cut off immigration. I would simply cut it by about two-thirds.
I've never quite been able to understand the concept that somehow America has been the melting pot, but I think the pot is full. And that those of us who look at these questions from a almost scientific perspective realize that we're reaching a limit here. I guess we could continue, but the question is that going to serve us well? Is that going to really add to our quality of life? What's the balance as the population really continues to increase?
Right, and I think people have a very poor understanding of where we're at. I think most Americans, if you ask them questions about what is the population of the United States, say, or what should it be, they would be fairly clueless about it. But interestingly enough, in surveys, most Americans are opposed to high immigration levels, and this crosses all racial and ethnic boundaries. If you were to ask African Americans or Hispanic Americans that question, they'd be similarly opposed to high immigration levels. And in a way, it stands to reason. If you're a population that has economic difficulties, you don't want to see enormous amounts of competition for available jobs. And that is what generations of African-American leaders have said. And yet, we have these very, very high immigration levels. And again, I would say that largely it serves business interests.
Business, money, stuff, economics, development, expansion, retirement, markets, tax breaks, investments. Where do we go from here? We'll continue our discussion following this brief and important announcement.
Come on up for the horizon. Come on up, clear heads in mind. Come on up for the horizon. Come on.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Okay, admit it. Something's just not making sense here on good old planet Earth. Can we sort this out? We'll just have to wait and see when your Voice of the Earth continues into the birth-dearth debate here
on the Wild Side News. We're talking with Jim Motovalli, who is the editor of E, the environmental magazine, about an article that they have featured in the November-December 2006 issue, which has to do with birth dearth, and it has to do with very complex trends that are going, some up, some down. But Jim, let's talk now about what this means for the future of the planet. What really are the deeper issues that relate to population?
Well, I think in the coming years, in the fairly near future, indeed you could say it's already started, we're facing two very big crises. One of those is global warming, and I think there's hardly a scientist out there who will refute the fact that global warming is a huge problem and will lead to much disruption of our agricultural resources, change the climate, and have many other mostly undesirable repercussions. The other is loss of drinking water, and we're already in a big crisis. If you look at, even in the United States, where you see some of our huge aquifers have already been drawn down to very dangerous levels. And around the world, there are still hundreds of millions, if not billions of people who do not have access to clean drinking water. And that's compounded by, in general, projections of lesser availability of drinking water, in part because of global warming repercussions. So the planet itself is facing a host of problems, and to this we are adding greater and greater human populations. We're currently at 6.5 billion, and we're heading towards 10 or 11 billion people. Probably at that time, if we reach 10 billion, population will level off and start to decline. That is the world projection. That's the way most demographers see it. We're going to eventually have population decline. But it's going to get much bigger before those numbers start to go down.
You know, a real complicating aspect of this as well that I'm sure many people talk about, but needs to be discussed here, and that is that it's no longer just a matter of increasing population, but it's also the fact that with this increasing population comes an ever-increasing industrialization and modernization, and therefore consumerism that is associated with these increased populations, and I think that's a huge part of the problem.
Well, let's use China as an example of what you're talking about.
Perfect example, yeah.
China is India will soon surpass China as the most populous nation, which is interesting, in large part because of their one-child policies in China. But China will surpass the United States as the number one emitter of global warming gas. And this is in large part to the improving economic conditions for the average Chinese and the emergence of a Chinese middle class. A whole lot more people in China have cars than would have had them 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And along with growing economic prosperity has come the wholesale destruction of the Chinese environment. And right now, China has the worst air pollution in the world. People who go there are struck by how bad it is. We cannot afford to have the Chinese driving automobiles at the same level as the United States does. You can see that as sort of hypocritical, because who are we to claim we have the right to drive cars and they don't?
Yeah, you go tell them, would you?
But the planet is clearly not able to sustain the level of global warming emissions that would come from billions and billions more cars added to the planet. And that's what we're doing. Even though we have the Kyoto Treaty in place for most of the world except the U.S., a lot of nations, even though they've signed it, are not adhering to it. And all the trends are to increase carbon dioxide emissions. So we're not even close to meeting the Kyoto goals. And Kyoto is just a minor blip of what we actually need to do. So for all these reasons, I don't think we're in any position to keep increasing the population at these heady rates. We are now doing it.
You know, we have these trendy concerns, and certainly I don't mean to suggest that global warming is a trendy concern, but it has captured the attention of the populace at large, and that's a very good thing. However, sometimes that overshadows other issues that I think confuse people. For example, when we talk about CO2 and how this may be impacted by the increases of populations in China, that's all absolutely right, but as those people consume, then you start to look at it's going to involve many millions of more homes, and you start looking at the natural resources, the plastics that are required to produce all the new TVs, the precious metals, and that means that as the population increases and spreads out over the planet, at the same time now, you have an increased need to tear up the earth to try to supply all of those needs. And I don't know, that to me becomes a war zone.
Well, let's look at another factor that I haven't mentioned up to this point, which is the end of cheap oil. Now, I'm of the opinion, and a lot of oil geologists would agree with me, that we've basically reached peak oil, which is the period at which oil demand is greater than oil supply. So prices start going up. We've obviously started witnessing that. If you see prices going down a little bit, they're not going down to levels where they were before, and I'm not sure they ever will. We have reached a point where most of the oil we have left in the ground is harder and harder to extract. Now, our lifestyle in the United States is very dependent on cheap oil. We're on wheels. We're spread out in suburbia. It takes a lot of petroleum to keep that lifestyle humming. And again, population is very unsustainable without cheap oil. And a lot of our agricultural production is dependent on very cheap oil. And that's one of the reasons, that's one of the other major reasons we're facing an environmental crisis and why we can't afford the kind of population growth we're projecting. And it is true that many countries have birth dearth, and it is true that population will eventually decline, but it's still going to grow a lot before it does.
Well, Jim, the question that I think we have to continue to face more directly all the time is how in the world is this planet supposed to deal with this global problem? Because it, as you say, any emerging nation with people who've been impoverished, and they want the goods too. Who are we to say that they shouldn't or that they can't? And yet somewhere there's got to be a give point here, because it cannot continue. Where is that change going to happen? What are you envisioning?
Well, addiction to cheap oil has been sort of a bipartisan commitment. And I'm not seeing a lot of real leadership. It's not out of government anyway. It's coming out of grassroots groups. And I think what people need to get is the conservation message. What we're looking at is replacing oil is not going to be easy. And there's no easy magic bullet answer to replacing cheap oil. There are a number of things that might have a lot of promise, and be biofuels, you know, ethanol and biodiesel, and hydrogen is promising. Electric vehicles are promising. A lot of things that do not involve carbon emissions look promising, but most of them are much smaller in terms of resources or in their capacity to grow in the short term than oil is today. We have no way to just one-on-one replace oil with something else. Therefore, at least half of what we need to do is energy conservation. The rest of it may be alternative fuels. We may be able to do a whole lot with solar energy. We may do a whole lot with wind energy. But we're not going to just suddenly replace one liquid fuel with another and people won't even notice the difference. That isn't going to happen. There's no prospects for that. Maybe hydrogen is the best solution in the long term, but it's still a long-term solution right now.
You know, the trade-off for me, and I always find this interesting, I oftentimes think about economics, because a lot of this debate, it actually started the debate in terms of the effects of birth dearth, had to do with the economic effect, and quite honestly, at this point, economics to a large degree, ends up being digits in computers. They're just electronic information is all that really economics is. People can transfer $1 million from this bank to a bank in France, and it's all done on a computer, and nothing has changed except digits, okay? So from my perspective, when people start talking about the difficulties of birth dearth, it really comes down to an economic issue and that some sectors of the economy may be affected. How do we take care of our elders? It's a money issue. From my perspective, we simply must start to envision a new way to deal with this economic crisis, because sustainability is something that will benefit everybody.
Well, you know, if you look back through history, if you go back, even to the turn of the century, 1900, and look at conditions then, and I'm not sure exactly what the population was.
I think it was about 2 billion.
2 billion, okay.
Mm-hmm, I think so.
A lot of people see that period as sort of a golden age for the United States. We weren't suffering because our population was 2 billion. And I think if we could stabilize the population, it would be a really good thing. We're not going to stabilize world population at 2 billion, but if we can prevent the planet from growing hugely over the next 50 years, we're certainly done a good thing. And again, I want to point out the Bush administration's role in doing exactly the opposite by discouraging birth control and refusing to support any health clinic where abortions are performed. They have an effect of drastically increasing birth rates around the world.
Well, there are changes ahead of us, and hopefully there'll be changes that lead to intelligent discussion, rational solutions, and ultimately sustainability. Sustainability is a great term, although it almost is a little too soft. It really has to do with survival, and we are facing literally survival issues. This is a debate that we're going to hear a lot more about. Do you have any concluding thoughts that you'd like to share at this point, Jim?
Well, I think that people listening, if they hear the words birth dearth, they should not assume that the population problem has been solved and that we now have a different problem, which is not having enough people. It's definitely not as simple as that. You need to look at the whole question. And I hope that people do visit our website at emagazine.com, get a sense of all the different things we do in E. Obviously, it's not all about population. The cover story in the story on in the issue on birth dearth is actually about organic wine, and we have a whole thing on that, as well as stories on rooftop gardening and healthy hospital food and sustainable jewelry. So it's a pretty reader-friendly magazine. I think your listeners would find it an easy read.
As you say, it's a really nice balance. It isn't all about the threats. It's also about a future that is sustainable and healthy. And we need to just keep on promoting that vision all the time. And certainly, E! The Environmental Magazine does a good job at that. We've been talking with Jim Motovalli, who is the editor of E! The Environmental Magazine. Jim, I want to thank you so much for lending your voice here on the Wild Side News.
Yeah, great to be on.
Which way, then, do we go to the future? Personally, I'm heading to the organic wine section of the E! The Environmental Magazine. As I think about the upcoming parties I'm planning to attend, we need a break. And that's where we go now, for an invitation to a great fun way to laugh and just plain have fun. It's time for a little entertainment break. Well, we're finishing up another week here, and it's a hectic time of the year when everyone's off running to different parties, all sorts of fun things happening. People are getting ready for the big holiday season. And there's oftentimes a terrific number of great movies, or not so great movies, that come out right about now. And I got a call from a listener who said, you've got to go see this movie. It's a great movie. And we're talking now with Jack Cardoza. Jack, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sid. Nice to talk with you.
Well, okay. What movie is it that I'm supposed to go see?
You know, it's a movie that fits right into the Wild Side theme, although at first blush you might not realize that, and that's Happy Feet.
Okay, Jack, what in the world was it that you found so entertaining that you gave me a call to tell me that I had to go listen to this movie?
Well, the first off thing, Sid, is it's pure joy. The movie is just, it's a giggle. From beginning to end, it does have a little bit of a dark side kind of theme that, you know, it comes, but it is so fun. It's kind of a Penguin rock opera with an environmental twist. It's really about the plight of the penguins but it's wrapped in this beautiful, joyful frolic that you go through with Robin Williams as the voice and several characters, and Nicole Kidman has a voiceover, and Frodo is even in it. He's the lead penguin, and it is fun. It's very, very fun, but they have a nice little way of walking you right into the plight of the penguin through this joyful, animated, it's animated isn't even the right term. It's more like hyper real. They're doing something with the animation now that I need to look more into because I don't fully understand it. But the realism of the birds, the vividness of the color, their walk, they don't talk, but the way they talk and the way they giggle and wiggle when they walk is very compelling. It pulls you into it, and so there's. You know, it's this interesting blend of reality and delightful voiceovers and the story about the penguins, and it's all rolled into this great animation. Believe it or not, Warner Brothers mega hit. It was number one at the box offices for I think 3 weekends, and then I finally caught wind of it and said, "Wait, there's got to be something to this." And didn't know what I was walking into, but it was a joy. And I've seen it twice already, and probably going to take another friend to it before too long.
Well, you're a good guy, but I have to believe that you're the kind of person that if this wasn't going the right direction, you'd probably just get up and walk out. But obviously, that's not what happened here.
Not at all. It had me glued to my seat and dancing and stomping my feet on the floor, and clever. Really clever, catchy tunes. It's just fun to be a part of.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess the music is really a sensational part of the movie.
Oh, I've been singing one of the songs in my head. You know how that happens every once in a while, and I'm walking along with that song in my head. I mean, delightfully so. But it's like that. You know, it has good rhythm and blues, and you know, these sexy little penguins are doing this mating dance, and it's cute. It's very, very cute.
I don't want to become indelicate, but you actually found yourself being rather charmed by some of these penguins.
Extremely charmed. I want to go date a penguin. I mean, they look like they have a great lifestyle.
You got to like cold, though, I'll tell you that. You really have to be prepared. Now, let's say, okay, so you, I happen to know that you went with a friend of yours who's also another adult, and that even though you don't have kids, you thought this was well worth the effort to go and see it.
We were just, poking each other in the elbow going, "My God, look at that. Can you believe this now? Can you believe this? And there's Robin Williams again." And, I walked out with a bruised elbow, from the back and forth poking, and we were just, we had a ball. And just, and here again, it's very comedic. They've got these clever little, kind of like Cheech and Chong group of little studly penguins that are in part of it, and they kind of steal the show. But, they great lines, whoever the writers were, was very clever. But see, the beauty in this is you get the environmental message wrapped in mirth. It's wrapped in this wonderful, joyous, comedic kind of frolic, and then they slide in this very serious what's going on in Antarctica message. And so the delivery system is really great for the reality of and for us to pay more attention to what's going on in Antarctica.
Well, now, we certainly don't want to divulge too much of the plot, but does it touch on the area of global warming and the effects on the penguins?
I think you're going to go have to see the movie to get that answer.
Well, Jack Cardoza, listen, you've inspired me. I have a friend coming and visiting from Germany. I think that's a great way for us to spend a Saturday evening going out to see Happy Feet.
You'll love it.
Thanks, Jack.
Nice to be a part of your show, Sid. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
It's definitely a Happy Feet state of mind that pulls me in the right direction. So until we meet again next Thursday or any time on the archives, this is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.